Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 34. My name is Karen. I'm joined by Kristen. Hello.
Hello.
I did it in the right order this week.
You did.
I made sure I did.
Very good job.
Thank you. You can contact us at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. We have some stuff to discuss today. We're doing our What If Season 3 episode, so we're talking about Titan's Curse, which is pretty exciting. But before we get into that, we've got a couple news and updates. Not a whole lot, but some interesting stuff. Reed Riordan put up a couple of articles this week, including what to do when you lose your divine weapon, which is out of the Arusha book series.
Gotcha.
And it's pretty cute. They have some good suggestions. And I wouldn't read it if you haven't read City of Gold yet.
Okay.
But it's cute, mm-hmm. And I feel like could probably apply to several other Riordanverse series. People are always losing things.
Oh, yeah.
They also put together a list of the Rick Riordan Presents books that represent Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and there are quite a few on here. I'm very proud of of Rick Riordan Presents. We have the Pandava Quintet, we have the Thousand Worlds series, you know, first one by Roshni Chokshi, second one by Yoon-Ha Lee, the Gifted Clan series by Gracie Kim, second one's coming out very soon, more on that later, City of the Plague God by Sarwat Chadha, Pahua and the Soul Stealer from Lori M. Lee, Winston Chu versus the Whimsies by Stacy Lee. I mean, there's so many books to read.
I was just thinking about it as you said that just now, and I'm thinking about, like, all the different Asian American, series, like, just in general, what could come to my head, and I'm like, there are quite a few, but there's so much mythology in, like, that area of the world mm-hmm. that I think has been really untapped.
Yeah.
That it doesn't surprise me that we've got so many different Asian American, mythologies being represented here. So
definitely, because really cool. I think even as Americans without, like, a broad look at the world, I think a lot of people are still familiar with, like, a lot of the Mexican kind of folklore and stuff, like Aztec Mayans. We've heard a lot about those. Native American, we've heard a fair amount about. Obviously, Greek mythology, Norse mythology, Egyptian mythology are pretty standard in the West. But a lot of, like, Chinese, Korean, Japanese folklore and stuff, like, I don't think we learn that as much as we do the other ones. So.
There's a few things that we pick up on, you know, that have made their way into mainstream culture. I think kitsune have kind of become a well-known thing.
A lot of different, like, shows and movies have played
and
on that.
And even kitsune even have different interpretations mm-hmm. based on what, like, cultural approach you're taking to it. Like,
yeah.
I believe, you know, Korean mythology has a different look at kitsune than Japanese mythology yeah. and such, so on and so forth. So, yeah, like, it's really crazy how much we don't touch on mm-hmm. the Asian mythologies. Like, there's so many that have been untapped. So, I think it's really cool that there's so many represented in RRP.
Yeah, and I'm really interested to learn more about Chinese, like, mythology and folklore, because I know nothing about that. So, Winston Chu is kind of high up on my list right now. Okay, so Percy Jackson and the Olympians TV show news. We got a couple of little tidbits here and there. So as we're recording this, there is less than a week until filming, which is so crazy. Episode 1 is actually going to begin filming on June 2nd, not June 1st. Don't know why it moved back a day, but
I thought it was really funny that they, like, kind of made an announcement.
Yeah.
Like, by the way, filming is moved a day.
Yeah.
More on that later. Like it just seemed really funny because we're all, like, wildly anticipating or whatever. And instead of some big announcement, I just thought it was funny.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's cute. We don't know what they're shooting or, you know, who's shooting it or any of that, really. But
I think we know who's shooting it.
Well, I mean, like, the characters, like, who's going to be in the... That's what I meant. Not who, it's going to be James Bobin. We know that. But, yeah, like, I just thought it was funny that they made this big thing. Like, we're moving shooting a day.
Yeah. Becky tweeted, "Wish I could impart some knowledge as far as casting saying the studio knows the details are very important to you all. Will actors for episode 1, which starts filming on June 2nd, be revealed soon? I consulted the Stony Face of Wisdom on Sunday, and he was less than helpful. That's Zeus, right? That's meant to be Zeus, I assume?
That's gotta be Zeus.
It looks like naked. Zeus. Anyway. I don't, his hand is weird on the ground, like... The whole thing's a little awkward.
His beard is very long and distracting. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yes, I think that is supposed to be Zeus.
So, yeah. So, we know that episode 1 will start filming on June 2nd. So, we can kind of extrapolate some of the people who will be in that episode, which is kind of exciting. But we still don't know some of the actors. And that reminds me that Becky also tweeted...
To jump back a second, this stony guy...
Yeah.
This is at Rockefeller Center.
Okay.
Which is pretty close to the Empire State Building. So I'm curious if they're like, it looks like a picture of it. I'm curious if she took this picture.
Yeah.
Or if it's just a stock photo she got from the internet somewhere. You know, like, because Rockefeller Center's in New York. We know they're shooting in Vancouver, yeah. But there are some pretty iconic things in Lightning Thief. So I wonder if they're location scouting for some very specific
scenes. And I do see the alt tag. I don't know if you, did you check the alt tag? Oh, yeah, because she says it's on the facade of the main building at Rockefeller Center in New York City. Looks like Zeus to me, but Rockefeller Center website refers to the relief as Wisdom, capital W, artist Lee Laurie and colorist Leon V. Salon.
Yeah, I just did a Google image search and was like, I wonder where this is, just out of curiosity to see if it told us, like, for sure that it was Zeus. But that's interesting to me. I missed this tweet. I see all of her tweets. I missed this one. So, yeah.
I have a feeling Becky's going to be a little tricky because I feel like she's going to give us clues and we're not going to know their clues until later. And she actually says this in another tweet. She goes, as we go into the filming process, I need to be very careful of what I reveal to you all so not to spoil things. I'm going to be a bit naughty and tell you that the table read we just finished tonight was wonderful to have lucky to have such brilliant actors. I'm like, there's a random clover there. No, that means lucky, Karen. You're silly goose. And then she goes, Chiron, oh my God, so excited about this actor, spontaneously started laughing in the middle of the read. Happy tears here, people. So episode 1's funny. That's good to know.
Okay, what if I just had a thing? Like, what if Chiron is like Dax Shepard or something?
Why him?
I don't know why. He just popped in my brain.
Just randomly. I was like, did you get that from the clover? Like, I was like, Logan Lucky, it's gonna be...
I don't know, his... face just Adam. Popped in my brain and was like, he could be
whatever,
like,
his name
he's
is.
Funny, like, my brain was like, who's funny? Like, that's a pretty broad question, but that's who popped in my head. I don't know. Anyway, sorry, I'll move on.
Interesting. We're gonna be a little chaotic here today, people.
It just is.
I apologize.
It's a chaotic week.
Yeah. So I also just wanted to say the good thing about the advent of social media is there are a lot more behind the scenes videos now, and a lot of, like, teases and pictures and all this kind of stuff, which I thought was kind of fun. So if you're not already following the cast and the crew, and especially the three kids, go do that. They all have social media accounts. And this is a good reminder that there are a lot of shows in Vancouver, so not everyone hanging out with the cast will be on the show. Becky was sure to say that.
Especially this summer, because, like, as much as... they're starting in June, which means they'll probably be shooting, my guess is, through some of July or most of July, maybe two, depending on how long these episodes take to shoot. A lot of, like, the CW shows, I know, the ones that are coming back, come back, like, they start shooting in, like, the very beginning to mid-July. So, like, as normal shooting schedule stuff starts, there will be a lot of familiar faces running around Vancouver, so... just something good to keep in mind.
Yeah. And James Bobbin posted the, basically, camera tests for Percy Jackson are underway, and he posted a picture of the camera, and it's got the little Percy Jackson logo on it, and it made me so happy.
I know, right? It's really the little tiny baby things that get us the most excited. Like, seeing a camera, like, it's a camera, yeah, but it's got the Percy label on it, so we know what that means. And
it's official.
It's very, very exciting.
It's weird. I know that filming is so close, but I feel like it's not quite real yet. Yeah. Like, when they actually are there filming and we hear little tidbits, then it'll start to feel like that process is real.
Yeah.
And then we still gotta wait till January. Forever. Yeah, January for it to be over, filming to be over, right. And then all of the post-production, and right. then actually coming out, so... Yeah, it's a lot. Anyway, let's switch over to some more good news, some very, very good news. Marco Shiro tweeted a thread about the Slangelo book. They said, Slangelo fans, I'm happy to report that the upcoming book is now done, asterisk. Rick Riordan and I have finished all the major revisions. And he says, done equals it heads to copy edits. This is a major milestone in the process of making a book. It means that all parties agree that it's ready. That is a major milestone. That yes. means everything Mark wrote... Rick approves of, Mark approves of Rick's edits, you know, any changes they had to make, and the story is done. I was going to say,
pretty much the story is locked.
Yeah, exactly.
They know the start, the middle, the end. Mm-hmm. There is a book. Yes. The book exists.
Yes. Mark also wrote, at the copy edit stage, lots of grammar, spelling, punctuation, continuity, timeline, and other granular details will be fixed. But unless the copy editors find major flaws none of us spotted, then this is basically it. The Slangelo book is pretty close to its final form.
The copy editors would have to find a massive plot hole, which I trust that there probably is not one.
Between the two of them going through it several times, they probably caught all the holes. So
I agree. I 100% agree.
We actually tweeted at Mark and said, okay, so if this book is kind of in the final form, how long is it going to be? Because the last we heard it was 117,000 words and, you know, we were just curious if it got shorter, if it got longer. And they said it actually got a little bit longer. It is officially 119,000 words right now, which is a hefty book.
Yes, it is.
I feel like 60,000 is like fairly standard. That's probably like that might be a little short, like maybe a 250 page book, okay. maybe 300. So you're looking at probably a 500, 550, maybe 600 page book.
So that's like...
Which I don't think is like too big for Rick's other books. He's written them that right. big before.
Well, I'm just trying to think like, that's like almost Goblet of Fire length.
I think so, yeah.
600 I think is close to... I do not remember that well.
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking about the size of this tome that is going to be on the shelf.
I'm trying to remember. I'm pretty sure some of the Trials of Apollo books were like in the 500s. Were like they were... Okay. Yeah, they were pretty big.
Because I mean, when I think about Rick's books, I don't necessarily think of them as being huge. Like when you think about Harry Potter, when you think about Lord of the Rings, you think about it being these huge books. But like, I don't necessarily think that first, so... Yeah, that is really interesting. Mm-hmm. I'm glad it's long. I mean, it's a Nico book. There's a lot to cover in there. So, yeah, no, I'm really excited about it. But, that's going to be nice to get, like, a really big, hefty, long story. I think that's going to be
Mark
awesome.
Previously said they put everything they wanted into this book. So, hopefully it's everything we want as well.
I think it will be.
They also tweeted, working with both Rick Riordan and Stephanie Lurie has been a dream. Honestly, the funnest part of this process was getting the manuscript back from Rick to see what he changed and added to the first drafts I wrote. I got this huge rush because I felt like I was getting a present. Like, I really don't want to negate how absolutely surreal it's been for me as a fan to get to experience a Percy Jackson book before everyone else, because Rick surprised me so much. There are jokes in this book that made me cry laughing that I wasn't expecting. I think you're all in for a treat. This will be a very unique experience for a PJO book, as we both try things that hadn't been done before. It'll also be interesting to see what y'all think each of us wrote. I predict that our styles melded so much you won't be able to tell. And again, shout out to Stephanie Lurie for their editorial brilliance in facilitating all the back and forth. I'm so proud of what we did in this book. I truly believe it's the story that both Nico and Will deserve after all these years. You'll get more official info later this year. There's no cover, no art has been completed for the interior, but there's a title. And now, off to do a big restructure on my next YA book, which is out March 28th, 2023.
I'm just throwing this out into the universe. I foresee us trying to decide who wrote what things.
Like,
I think this is going to be a thing. I don't necessarily think we're going to have an entire episode called What did Mark write? What did Rick write? Let's break it down. But I have a feeling that we're going, as we read through this book, because that's a thing that's going to happen, I can see us going like, you know, Mark definitely wrote this section. Like this, you know, I feel like this has Mark and this had to be Rick. Like yeah. This is such a Rick thing. But like, I'm really looking forward to seeing how well they blend because mm-hmm. I can't say I've read anything that Mark's written yet. I don't think I have. Maybe something snuck in there that I'm forgetting. But, like, it'll be really interesting to see if I can decipher, like, the difference between their styles or if it's, yeah, just, like, that well blended.
Yeah. I have a feeling it is going to be pretty tough. One, because I think Mark will be adept at copying Rick's style. And two, like, I feel like Rick, maybe if there's something in there that's really surprising and different that, like, Mark had thought up and Rick agreed to it, but I don't know. I can't really think of anything either. I mean, I've read, like, a short story by Mark, but that was very different than the Percy Jackson universe, so
yeah,
we'll just have to see.
It's gonna be fun.
Yeah. I'm excited. I think everybody's excited.
Just a little.
You know what else I'm excited for?
Movies?
Yes. Leah's new movie, which I'm referring to as Leah's new movie and not Idris Elba's new movie, which is hilarious. But we got the trailer for Beast, which is the movie that she's starring in as Idris Elba's daughter. And it comes out August 19th. The trailer's pretty intense. Did you watch it? I know you don't always watch trailers.
Nope.
Okay, that's fine. The Beast is a lion, which I was not expecting.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that's, you know.
Karen's just throwing spoilers out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's in the trailer. It's not that much of a spoiler.
I'm teasing. No, I remember hearing something about this movie prior to the Leah stuff. It must have been because I was reading an article about Idris or something. But no, I'm definitely interested, and I probably will watch this trailer soon, but I have not because trailers are weird with me.
So. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's going to be pretty intense, and I guess, like, this kind of movie is, you know, that's kind of what you're looking for, is, like, a little bit of a scare, a little bit of a adventure.
We'll definitely be getting this movie before anything else, aka mm-hmm. anything Percy, so I'm interested to see Leah.
Yeah.
In this role. It's going to be good fun.
Yeah, because I think compared to some of her other roles, this is obviously going to be, like, a lot more grown up. Like, yeah. She's a little bit older, and it's a more adult, like, intense kind of movie. So, yeah. I will be curious about it as well. Last bit of important news is that The Last Fallen Moon by Gracie Kim has been pushed back from June 7th to June 14th. She tweeted, a quick piece of news, due to supply chain issues, The Last Fallen Moon will now be dropping 14th of June. Same book, same author, just 1 week later. For those who read The Last Fallen Star and have been waiting for book two, yay, I can't wait to share this with you. So,
there's a lot of that stuff going around right now, yeah. A couple of my authors have said that even, like, Barnes & Noble is having trouble getting certain books in stock. Not, like, new ones, usually. It's a lot of, like, backstock stuff, but they're just having trouble keeping things in print.
Which is hilarious, because Wicked Beauty by Katie Robert landed in people's, like, mailboxes, like, 2.5 weeks early.
Oh, I think it all just depends on how long ago they put in orders and, like, that sort of thing. Because, like, I know one of the authors I follow, Rebecca Yaros, like, they're prepping for a pretty major romance book signing, and she's like, I may or may not have copies of two of my most popular books because Barnes & Noble is having trouble getting them in stock, and I, you know, one of them is, like, has a special deal with Barnes & Noble, so she has to buy their stock through them or whatever, and it's, like, a whole thing. She's like, I have no idea if I'm gonna have copies, so we'll see what happens.
It's
all just due to supply chain shenanigans and all that stuff.
I'm not that mad about this, to be honest, because we always like to have a little extra time before we jump into books. And I guess there's no harm in saying that we are going to be talking to Gracie Kim as well about The Last Fallen Moon, which is pretty exciting. We will also be reading The Last Fallen Star for the actual podcast. We'll do the same thing we did with Ballad and Dagger. We'll do a little bit on The Last Fallen Star, and then we'll talk to Gracie. It'll be all exciting and wonderful.
Yeah.
Hope you guys like that.
I was going to say, we'll be reading the first book, not the second one, for the discussion, though. So if you haven't read the first one, don't stress out.
Yeah.
That's the one we're going to be talking about. Because Kristen's behind again.
We're all behind all the time. We are behind together, therefore nobody is behind.
Nice. I like it.
No one left behind.
I like it.
let's talk about our what if scenarios. If you are new here and you haven't heard us do the what if scenarios before, you can go back to episode number 9, which is called Twice as Smelly. And we do kind of a more general one. That one's not just Lightning Thief. It's a lot of Lightning Thief, but we kind of pick and choose from other places as well. I think there is a Titan's Curse one in there.
We weren't sure of what we were doing yet.
Yeah, exactly. And then we realized, hey, we can do this for every book. So on episode 23, Dark Sad Brother Vibes, we did one about Sea of Monsters specifically.
Anyway.
Yeah. So there's that. But today we are going to be talking about our Titan's Curse what if scenarios. Now I have to once again give a shout out to New Rachel at RachelJoy23, who reminded us that we do this and, you know, has more things in order than I do. So
we were spinning forward thinking about all the authors that were coming up with book releases, and then we were thinking about like casting things and trying to figure out how that was all fitting into the schedule, and then it was like, oh wait, we have one more, this time we didn't have a film adaptation to dive into because there isn't one for Titan's Curse on, but we can continue to do our What If episodes, so it was a really lovely reminder. Thank you, Rachel.
I just had an idea of what if we talk about what the Titan's Curse movie could have been like and how they could have further fixed the plot. That would be kind of interesting. We'll just lay that one out there. If you guys are interested, we'll do it. Our schedule's a little crazy coming up, but we might have room for that.
If that sounds like an interesting episode, let us know.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Rachel did give us some specific what-if scenarios. I swear, I did not steal yours. I forgot that you put this in there. So one of mine is the same as one of yours. And a few other people had mentioned the other one. And then the third one we'll talk about in a bit.
I was going to say, in all fairness, some of them are kind of like the obvious questions you ask. Yeah. Like, what if this instead of this? Or what if this person did this? Mm-hmm. Like, some of them are kind of instinctual.
Yeah, because there are a lot of really pivotal moments in Titan's Curse that change a lot of what's to come. So I feel like playing around with those ideas is particularly interesting. So let's just kick this off.
I was going to say, and then there's the things I chose, which are completely ridiculous.
No, I liked yours, though. I think it's good, because I feel like I did take some really obvious ones.
Yeah, okay, no more teasing. We'll get into it.
So starting off, I asked, what if Zoe had survived? So basically, Talia never would have become lieutenant, first and foremost. I guess we don't really know for sure if she would have joined the hunters, but by that point, I feel like she was already leaning toward maybe joining them.
Well, it would have taken her out of contention for the prophecy, right. So I really do think she would have ended up as a hunter, but I'm curious if Zoe being the lieutenant would have been enough to keep her out. Like, would Zoe have, you know, Zoe being the head honcho, basically, other than Artemis, would that have been enough for Talia to rethink it?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't think so, just because, like, being a part of that prophecy is kind of a big deal. So right. I think she would have taken herself out, but then you would have had a whole nother plot line of Talia and Zoe just trying to get along.
Like, that would have been a whole book series on its own.
Exactly. Now, that also means that somebody else would have died by their parents' hand. And the only one that makes sense to me is Talia, because, like, you're not going to kill Percy, you're not going to kill Annabeth. So really, I mean, Grover, but I feel like Talia is just the more obvious choice.
I mean, I could see there being a situation where Percy dies at Poseidon's hand, but it's not, like, permanent.
It's like a Harry Potter thing where he gets, like, resurrected?
Well, or something. Like, Percy dies at Poseidon's hand, and then Annabeth says, no, and, like, does CPR and brings him back in a completely human way or something.
What if he can't really drown, but, like, what if he drowns, which is dying by Poseidon's hand technically, and then Annabeth brings him back with CPR?
I was gonna say, I think Percy could drown if it was completely removed from the sea. We know he has, like, control over water in general, but I think if he was in, like, a deep enough body of water or something that was not the sea, there could be some conflict there.
Also, if Poseidon takes his favor away from Percy, like,
or Percy's doing the noble thing and sacrifices himself and forces himself to drown so that he's killed by his father's hand.
This got dark.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking of things Percy would do.
Yeah.
And in order to save Annabeth and or anyone else, really, I can see him sacrificing himself and saying, well, if I drowned, then I'm kind of dying at Poseidon's hand. That will take that part of the curse away. And then Annabeth will be safe. And then Talia will be safe. So he does it. And then Annabeth is like, no.
Yeah.
You must live. I will fix it. Because I can, as long as, like, it's actually the words of the prophecy, we know these things are fishy anyway. As long as they're technically fulfilled. I didn't even think of that. As long as they're technically fulfilled, which him dying is what it says. It doesn't say he remains dead or is gone forever or anything like that. I think technically it could fulfill it without ever having to actually lose Percy.
Yeah.
Just something to think about. Anyway, yes.
I kind of went down that thread of if Talia does die and Zoe doesn't, does that mean Zoe would basically fill in Talia's plot in the future? Wouldn't be like a perfect fit because she's not a daughter of Zeus, but I feel like her being part of the Hunters, like whenever Talia comes in to help, it would have been Zoe instead, which would be interesting, but definitely a different vibe from, like between Percy and Zoe especially would be.
I'm pretty sure Zoe might have annoyed me more than Talia.
Yeah, I think so as well. And my last major question with this is, would Artemis have been as sympathetic to Percy and Annabeth during the winter solstice meeting if Zoe hadn't died?
I mean, it's definitely a good question.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if Zoe was alive and well, Artemis wouldn't be in the mindset she was in at the end there and thinking about what Percy and Annabeth did. And it's a good question.
I feel like she still would have been somewhat sympathetic because they did rescue her. They did, you know, come to help against all odds. They fought valiantly. She definitely appreciates that in a hero.
And if Percy still takes her place to hold the sky,
yeah. But I feel like Zoe was kind of the nail in the coffin. I didn't even want to say that. But I feel like that was kind of the final push Artemis needed to realize, you know, how big this whole thing was.
I definitely think you're right. It would have been an interesting scene if Zoe was alive and Artemis was faced with the same, like, scenario at the meeting. Yeah.
And I think she even would have felt sympathy if Talia was the one to have died because, you know, she wanted Talia to join, but Talia had to make that choice on her own. So I think it would have been maybe not quite as hard-hitting, but a lot of the same beats, I think, still would have been there.
I'm just thinking about if Talia had died instead of Zoe, would that have changed anything with the prophecy? Not really, because she basically takes herself out of the running moments later. Mm-hmm. So it really wouldn't have changed anything prophecy-wise. So
right.
Anyway, just a moment thinking it through to make sure that there wasn't like a looming giant cool thing that...
No. Yeah.
Nope.
What's your first what-if scenario?
Okay, so my first one... When I do these... I have a hard time following the chain of, like, events. Like, okay, well, this would definitely change, and then this, and then this, and then this. I more or less like to think about, like, if this changed, how would it change the characters? Like, could things have, you know, so I'm not necessarily as, like, cut and dry about it. But mine is, what if Dr. Chase was actually a terrible father and didn't care about Annabeth? Because, well, we know from Annabeth, she thinks that, like, you know, her dad doesn't care about her, and they live in a terrible place where she can't really be, and it's, you know, she kind of thinks he's being selfish by living there so that she can't really be there, and she doesn't want to be there anyway, and, you know, all that stuff. We've heard the past, the things that have gone on in the past between Annabeth and her dad. So if he was actually terrible and didn't care at all, when they got to the house, they would have just been sent away.
Mm-hmm.
And which means they wouldn't have gotten fed. They wouldn't have had a moment's respite because it wasn't a long time they were at his house, but it was enough to kind of give them a moment to breathe and not be worried about the next threat. And they got food and they were, you know, they had a moment to take a second and calm down. I'm curious, without food and some sort of nourishment, if they all would have just died on that mountain.
I mean...
Because it was not a light battle.
Right.
Like, definitely would have needed something to get them through it. And
maybe Percy wouldn't have lasted as long holding up the sky.
Right? Or if it would have actually crushed him, it would have meant all kinds of bad things for the world.
Yeah.
Like, if he just literally doesn't have the physical strength to hold it as long as he did, that would have been pretty monumental. There also would have been no car to get them up the mountain, no help saving them from the monsters on Othiris when her dad shows up in his plane. Phew. They never would have made it to Olympus on time, which means Bessie would have most likely been sacrificed.
Aww.
And I kind of jumped ahead because I couldn't remember exactly why Bessie was, like, super important. Like, I was like, I looked in the wiki and looked ahead to kind of see in Last Olympian and whatever. And Bessie doesn't, like, have a ton of stuff coming up that I can remember and that I could find. But I started kind of going down the line of, okay, what could have happened? And the wiki says this: if the Ophiotaurus's entrails are burned or sacrificed, the Slayer would gain the power to defeat the gods. And it started me thinking, like, does that include the other gods? Mm-hmm. So if, like, Ares had decided to sacrifice the Ophiotaurus, would he have gained more power and had the opportunity to overthrow the gods? Or it kind of just threw a question mark into the scenario, like, whoever is actually responsible for killing Bessie in that moment, would they have maybe unleashed this, like, oh, hey, by the way, I actually have my own plot and I want to overthrow the gods. Mm-hmm. Here we go. And so then you have Luke's whole thing and another plot to change things. Right.
The only reason why I feel like maybe the gods don't count is because they never actually talked about that during that meeting. They were never like, well, if we sacrifice this, who's actually going to do it? Because that means they'll gain extra power. So I wonder if, like, it has to be a mortal.
It's definitely just one of those questions. We don't know if it's a mortal thing. Like, yes, it has to be a mortal that sacrifices in order to get power or what. There's some open-ended things left in the Ophiotaurus' story. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, it's kind of a minor thing, but also kind of major. It could go either way.
I was going to say, I mean, how will that relationship affect Annabeth and her way of thinking? Like, I think that there are further ripple effects, but even just contained within Titan's curse, it would have had a major effect, I think.
I think so, too.
Yeah. Okay, my next one is, what if Percy had never met Rachel Elizabeth Dare? And this is the one I didn't steal from New Rachel. I'm sorry. But
there had to be some R.E.D.
Yes.
In these what ifs, there had to be.
And I think this one is actually really interesting. So, of course, we know that Percy meets Rachel at the Hoover Dam. And basically, she wouldn't have saved him from the Skeleton Warriors. I think he would have found another way to escape.
He's Percy.
But this was obviously, like, an easier scenario, so maybe he would have gotten injured or somebody else would have gotten injured or killed or something like that. And he wouldn't have known there are mortals who can see through the mist, right? Like, he hadn't experienced that yet, so that was a totally new phenomenon for him. He wouldn't have known that was even an option. And for me, that's kind of the most interesting, because that means that they wouldn't have recognized each other at school in Battle of the Labyrinth in the beginning chapters, and the evil cheerleaders might have gotten one up on them, so they wouldn't have looked for each other at orientation. Maybe, you know, Percy would have been killed because he wasn't with Rachel, or Rachel would have been killed because she wasn't with Percy. Or they had gotten through the school year or something, and the cheerleaders kind of caught them off guard. And basically, it would have taken them a lot longer to connect and for Rachel to be brought into this world. But I think after that, everything else would have been pretty much the same. Like, once she's aware of this world, she becomes the Oracle down the line, and then, you know, we're back in business. But would have been a little bumpier in the beginning, I think.
Right. Basically, if he hadn't met her at the dam, he would have met her at school.
Right.
Because it wouldn't have changed Rachel's story at all, and she lives in New York.
Mm-hmm.
But we wouldn't have gotten this really great interaction between them, like, did you really think I lived at the Hoover Dam?
Yeah.
And we would have missed all of that. So, yeah, I do think you're right that it wouldn't have changed the story in general, like, in Battle of Labyrinth and so on, as much. But it would have had a big impact on Titan's Curse and a little bit at the beginning of, like, Battle of Labyrinth.
And the most important question, would Annabeth and Percy have gone on their date?
I know, right?
If the cheerleaders hadn't attacked, which, like, maybe they still would have, but...
But if that got delayed because they didn't have a reason to... I think Percy and Rachel...
Coming together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of was, like, an impetus for that. So, like, if they hadn't recognized each other... Maybe the cheerleaders don't attack that day. Maybe they wait a little longer. Maybe they wait till the actual school year starts. So, yeah, Percy and Annabeth could have gone on their date. And maybe there would have been more hugs.
Maybe.
Like, lots more hugs.
Yeah.
Anyway, right, moving on.
What's your next one?
Mine is, what if Luke had let the general kill Annabeth? Okay, so this is kind of in the middle of Titan's Curse, where Artemis has arrived on the scene to save Annabeth, to take the sky from her. And so Annabeth is no longer holding up the sky. She's kind of been cast to the side. And the general says, like, hey, we can get rid of this girl. And Luke is like, let's actually wait till the solstice, because I think she could still be useful. If Luke had just let the general kill Annabeth, like, let's say Luke really has gone completely, you know, we like to think that Luke still has some good in him, but what if he's completely bad and he lets Annabeth die? First of all, no, I don't like this.
Yeah, no, we'll just stop.
We're just going to say no, this didn't happen. But my first question is, would Percy have ever recovered from that loss? Like, they aren't official or anything. There's no dating yet. I mean, they went on... They were going to go on a date. Mm-hmm. It was a friend hangout.
He didn't think it was a date,
right,
though.
It was a friend hangout. I will never, you know, never take that. But Annabeth has pretty much been the single most influential person to him since he found out about being a demigod. Like, there's Grover, who's been really important, and Chiron, who's been really important. But I think Annabeth, more than anyone, has made a huge impact on Percy's life. And, like, first of all, I don't think he would have moved on from that. I think it would have been an entirely different book series. We would have had an Order of the Phoenix where Percy is completely depressed and an awful human to be around because he has no hope and is totally over it and just doesn't care. I really think that would have been a crazy world to be in. An Annabeth-less world where Percy is trying to move on and has no, you know, like, I do think he would have tried to do right and do good things, but like, it would have been rough.
I'm curious who he would have connected with after that. Like, obviously he's still going to be very close to Grover, but I feel like maybe him and Talia would have become closer because Talia knew Annabeth before. It's something that they could really share together.
Yeah. No, I did give that a bit of thought. Like, if they had bonded over her loss, I do think they might have become better friends. I don't necessarily think it would have ever been anything more than that. No, so I don't think we would have had the Persebeth. I don't think we would have had Persalia.
Persalia?
Yeah.
Oh, I kind of like
Persalia.
That.
Persalia. I don't necessarily think we would have had that because they're very different people. But I do think they might have been really good friends. Mm-hmm. Even if she continues on and joins the Hunters, like, I could see them, like, staying in touch or something. Right. Iris messaging all the time or something like that. So it would have been interesting. Another question that goes along with this is, would it have changed Percy's mindset involving Luke?
Absolutely.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Like, we know he's not a big fan of Luke anyway. Every time Annabeth brings Luke up, Percy's like...
And he already thinks he deserves to die.
Right. So if Annabeth is dead, I do not question Percy would have killed him as soon as he saw him. Like, the first chance he gets, Luke's dead. And that could have had a pretty massive impact on the rest of the series. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that would have been bad. And then the last thing was just trying to wrap my mind around how the rest of the books would have gone on without Annabeth. Like, Battle of the Labyrinth without Annabeth. Or The Last Olympian without Annabeth at all would have been very, very different.
I also feel like this kind of melds into some of our other what-if scenarios, because if Luke had killed Annabeth and Percy had killed Luke in retribution, I think Percy would go off the deep end because, one, it wouldn't have changed anything. It wouldn't have brought Annabeth back to life.
Right.
Kronos wouldn't have had Luke to rely on to be his vessel, so he'd have to find somebody else. Percy is part of that great prophecy. He could be the one to destroy Olympus, so Kronos could have targeted him, and he'd probably be pretty mad at somebody like Athena for not making sure that Annabeth stayed safe. I think he could have possibly changed sides. I mean, maybe he wouldn't because he knows Annabeth didn't necessarily want to be on Luke's side.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it would have kind of sent him off the deep end.
Well, if everything that happened in Titan's Curse happened except Annabeth died, which it wouldn't have changed Titan's Curse very much. It wouldn't have changed the prophecy or anything like that in Titan's Curse. Does Nico become the one that Kronos goes after? Because we know he's kind of an eligible being for the prophecy. If Kronos goes after Nico, then Nico becomes the vessel and Percy is fighting Nico at the end of Last Olympian, and I don't want to see that.
Yeah.
I don't honestly even want to think about it, but it's like if Kronos says, like, I can't get to Percy. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no way he's going to join me now. If he logically thinks it through and just says, like, you know, there's absolutely no way he's going to see my way of thinking. The only other person left on the planet that fulfills the prophecy would have been Nico. So. Yeah,
that's true.
It's just, yeah, there's a lot of craziness that goes along with that one. And it's a minor thing. Like, I really didn't think it was going to have monumental implications. Like, oh, just, you know, the general thought about killing her anyway, but that would have been really bad.
Yeah, it would have been. I don't like thinking about a world without Annabeth in it.
Me neither.
Okay, we also have two bonus ideas. These are ones that are, like, a little less fleshed out. Mine is, what if Luke didn't survive the fall? So at the end, he falls off the cliff. Percy thinks he's dead. He's not. But what if he actually was? So basically, later on, Luke kind of comes to Annabeth and asks her to help him and that sort of thing. Like, that never would have happened. So Annabeth never would have felt guilty about rejecting him or any of that kind of stuff. And then the big question is, like, who would have become Kronos' vessel, basically? Because without Luke, you know, would it have been Nico? Would he have tried even harder to go after Percy? Or he'd have to find somebody else who had switched sides. But part of the reason why I think that he went after Luke is because, one, he could manipulate him, and two, Luke is very strong of will, and so I feel like nobody else would maybe be able to handle that.
Yeah, because as we know, like, Luke isn't a child of the big three, so that's not, like, a requirement to be his vessel.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if, like, a Clarice could have come in to play there, because she's, like, a very headstrong person, and I could see Kronos thinking, like, it might be hard to convince her, but if I can convince her, she'll never, you know, change sides.
She won't break. And if he can manipulate her relationship with Ares and say, this is how you impress your father,
right?
I feel like that could actually work. I mean, I trust Clarice to stay on the side of good because I think she, you know, despite all of her many flaws, she actually is a very good person and she kind of knows what's right. But that is a very sore spot for her. So,
oh, yeah. And I honestly do not want to see a Last Olympian book with Clarice as the vessel.
Yeah.
Like, Luke's bad enough.
That would have been kind of scary.
Whew. Okay.
Yeah. What was your last one?
What if Nico had gone to Percy for comfort instead of blaming him for Bianca's death?
I like this one. This one's nice.
This is actually one I kind of like. Because as much as, like, I love Nico, he's young, and him blaming Percy for Bianca's death is, it's logical. It's not crazy or anything like that. But I could also see in the same vein, this is basically just a small other universe, where Nico, like, looks at Percy and instead of getting mad, just lets his grief overwhelm him and he goes, you know, gets a hug from Percy. It made me wonder if Nico would have become a bigger part of the team earlier. Like, you know, later on we see his role in things, you know, develop. But if he's a part of the team earlier, they have access to his power and his abilities earlier, and Percy and Nico don't go through the events of the Battle of the Labyrinth because Nico probably wouldn't have been as vulnerable and wouldn't have been subject to, I'm going to say it, King Minos. If you're reading the books along with us, just pretend I didn't say that. But yeah, so
we've spoiled a lot of things. Yeah. This is definitely just a reread for us, so I'm not too worried about
it. I know, but I'm just saying. But yeah, like, it would have changed the Battle of the Labyrinth pretty dramatically, and so on and so forth. Also, would we have had to wait a long time then to discover Nico's godly parent? Because in his anger, he lets his power go, and that's when Percy really seals the deal and knows who his godly parent is. And then, yeah, how would that change what we know about Battle of the Labyrinth? It would have changed a lot.
This is really interesting to me because I think Nico still would have secluded himself. It just would have been at camp because he's depressed, and that makes sense. Percy would try to take care of him, and even if that did end up working, I think Nico is changed forever because of these events. I think you're right that we would have waited a longer time to discover Nico's godly parent, and therefore, like, because of his powers and stuff. And because of that, Percy wouldn't have declared himself, okay, I am child of the prophecy. How would that have actually changed Percy's mentality going into the labyrinth, going into the final battle? You know, he hadn't decided that he's taking this on his shoulders. Would he have been swayed down the line or something? I think that part's the most interesting to me.
I hear you there. Like, him making that choice, changing your mindset, it's, you know, rather than being a victim of the prophecy, Percy actively chooses to be who the prophecy is talking about. He says, no, it's me. I'm making the choice. It's me. And that there's a lot of power in just making that choice. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's a really interesting thought.
Yeah. These always have really interesting consequences when we go over these. Now, we actually had a ton of feedback this week with listeners writing in about their alternate universes and stuff, and I'm so excited to go through this. First and foremost, again, shout out to New Rachel at RachelJoy23, who said, also, Titan's Curse specific what-if scenarios. What if Percy hadn't met Rachel Darrett in the Hoover Dam? What if someone else had been taken instead of Annabeth? And a more general one, what if Luke had been the one who was turned into a tree and Talia had gotten to camp? So I want to take on the last one first because a couple other people suggested the other one as well.
Yeah.
So Luke gets turned into the tree, not Talia. I think he still would have been pissed at the gods. I don't think that would have changed because he was a tree for, you know, 7 years or however long it was.
Well, we know that Zeus saved Talia by turning her into the tree. Like, she was still alive. Mm-hmm. We didn't know she was ever coming back, but, like, the possibility of it was still there. Why would Zeus save Luke?
Right.
So, like, Talia would have had to have made an appeal to Zeus and said, you know,
that's
like,
true.
Save one of us, save the camp, save blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? So there would have had to have been an appeal from Talia, I think, to even have Luke turned into the tree. But if that all happened, how would that have changed? Talia being at camp, Luke not being able to be Cronus's, he still would have been mad, but I don't think Cronus has been working on Luke for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Would Cronus have reached out to Atalia, who's pissed at Zeus,
right,
or pissed at the gods in general for allowing Luke to been put in the position? Mm-hmm. How would that have changed Talia and Annabeth's relationship?
Right.
Would Talia have just ended up with the hunters earlier because she couldn't stand being at camp and seeing the tree and all of that?
I feel like if Talia appealed to Zeus to turn Luke into the tree, she has less of a reason to hate Zeus for what he did versus it being like just Zeus's choice out of the blue. I think when Luke woke up, I feel like it still kind of would have been him.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I am interested, like, how Talia's presence at camp would have affected Percy and Annabeth's friendship, if Talia and Annabeth were really close and stuff like that.
If Talia is not a huge fan of Percy when he first arrives, how does that influence Annabeth? Does Annabeth kind of take longer to warm up to Percy? Like,
yeah.
Would Percy and Grover and Annabeth would they have been the three to go on that quest in Lightning Thief? It changes a lot of things.
And how would Hermes react to Zeus turning his kid into the tree?
Yeah.
I mean, that could have been a very sore point.
Yeah.
So that's all very interesting.
Yeah, that's a big one, yeah.
Yeah. So just like Rachel said, we have Just a Positive Guy at Just a Positive G1 and The Best Damn Camp at Best Damn Camp Pod. That's kind of hard to say. Both said, what if Percy fell instead of Annabeth? What if Percy had gone missing instead of Annabeth? Very interesting. I mean, you'd have the entire book would be from a different, not from a different point of view, but you wouldn't see their quest to go save him. You would only see, like, the behind-the-scenes stuff. So
right.
All of the Atlas stuff, all of the Artemis stuff.
I honestly almost picked this one, and then I saw that it was chosen by a few of our commenters, and I was like, dang it, okay, I won't do this one. But yeah, like, it seeing things from the other side, not actually seeing the quest, but seeing Percy kind of putting together pieces, he would have put together, you know, who the general is, mm-hmm. even if he's a little out of it at first, just from the pain of holding up the sky and all that. Like, yeah, it would have been interesting to see from that side, but honestly, it probably could have been a little boring. Because after a while, there's not much going on.
Right,
like, at first, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff. And maybe Percy, imprisoned on the ship or imprisoned with Luke somewhere, learns more about what Luke's up to or something, but that's about it.
It would be less action, more just, like, regular kind of plot sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I think that is interesting, though. And you would have Grover with the empathy link, who would be able to find him.
Unless this book was told from Annabeth's perspective.
Right,
like, if Rick played a switcheroo and was like, okay, so Percy has now been the one taken. Let's see how Annabeth handles a quest without Percy. That would have, again, I would have loved to have read
it. I mean, I would have loved to have, like, heard, like, inside her brain at this point in the series. I think that would have been really cool.
Yeah.
All Things Ridenverse at All Things PJO says, what if Bianca and Nico didn't let themselves get led away from the dance? They screamed and got someone's attention instead. Think about it. That's an interesting one, too, because Dr. Thorne wouldn't have led them away. Percy wouldn't have gone with them, so they wouldn't have been outside. So would Dr. Thorne have attacked them in the school and would more people have gotten killed?
Mm.
And Annabeth wouldn't have gone over the cliff.
Yeah. So if Annabeth never goes over the cliff, do the events of Titan's Curse happen at all?
I mean, they probably do, but they would have...
They would have had to find another way to take someone to lure Percy to that side of the country.
Well, Artemis goes after Annabeth first, technically. Right. But she could still do that because she's trying to track... Well, she's trying to track Dr. Thorne.
Yes.
So...
Well, no.
She's not?
She's tracking Bessie.
Oh.
Like, she's tracking this mysterious monster, and it wasn't...
Was that Bessie?
I think it was actually supposed to be Bessie she was tracking, wasn't it?
Oh.
Well, I don't know.
Either way, I think Artemis would have ended up there. And I think Percy still would have had his dream. And even though he had the extra motivation to go after Annabeth, I think he still would have done what needed to be done. But it's not quite as, like...
Cut and dry.
Yeah.
Is it weird that reading this just now, I didn't think about the school dance. I thought about the Lotus Hotel.
Oh.
Like, I for some reason, I equated the dance with the Lotus Hotel. And, like, what if they'd never left the Lotus Hotel? And,
I mean, that would change everything.
Right? Yeah. That would be a pretty massive change, too.
Yeah, definitely.
I forgot that they were at a dance at the beginning of that. I was like, oh, wait, yeah.
That was a long time ago.
I knew they were at the school, but I forgot there was a dance.
Mm-hmm. Poseidon Boy at Aaron LG 43 says, what if Zoe had somehow managed to kill Atlas and that left Artemis to hold the sky, but then it turned into a larger conflict of who would hold the sky? I'd like to think Percy's fatal flaw would come into play there, or maybe Zoe would take it herself. So many outcomes. And I said, Percy would 100% volunteer and Annabeth would be like, don't be stupid. You can't hold up the sky forever. Because really, the only way that you can hold up the sky is if you volunteer or you trick somebody into doing it. So Artemis is the only one strong enough to hold up the sky because she's a god, and even she was struggling.
Yeah.
So she would have to get another god to volunteer.
Or a titan.
Or a titan, or would have to trick somebody else into doing it. And that would be very difficult. Like, hey, come into this cave. We just want to have a chat. And then, like, oh, what's happening over here? And they, like, push them and try to get them to fall under the sky or something.
Well, and then you start thinking about which gods or titans could be convinced. Like, obviously, you're not going to get a Zeus holding up the sky.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to think of what minor gods, like, could be lured away. Like, Mr. D holding up the sky.
He would never volunteer, though, yeah.
But, like, I could see them trying to trick him or something. Yeah. Like, that would be
a whole
thing. He's
too smart for them, though. And I feel like, okay, what if we all take turns holding up the sky? But then there's so much distrust among the gods that, like, nobody really would.
Well, I thought that, too. Like, okay, what if they take turns until there is someone to punish? Because clearly at the end of this, there's going to be somebody to punish, right? So they can make whoever is ultimately responsible hold up the sky. But they have to get there, which means someone would have to do it in the meantime. Right. And Artemis is not volunteering for 7, 8, 9 months, two years, 3 years of sky holding duty. No, that's not happening.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Because I really don't know the answer to that. Like, who would end up doing it?
Yeah.
Maybe it's just Artemis forever. That's sad. I bet one of her hunters would volunteer. Maybe all the hunters switch out, like, oh, I'm on, you know, sky guard duty today.
I wonder how long a hunter could hold up the sky. They're probably technically human, but they're immortal.
Yeah. Probably a fair amount. Well, because Artemis said Annabeth had the heart of a hunter, didn't she? And that's why she was able to hold it up longer, or the heart of a hero, like she was pure-hearted or something. So that's why she was able to hold it up for so long. So I bet the hunters, maybe they would just, like, rotate. They would do it for Artemis.
I mean, I'm sure they would do it for Artemis. They would do anything for Artemis.
And lastly, Winter Chim at Griffin_B1893 says, what if Nico snuck away on the quest like Percy did to protect his sister, and it ended up being the one who died in the junkyard? First of all, how dare you?
No. We're just, again, like we did earlier, just no.
But I like the idea of Nico sneaking away to go on the quest. I feel like that's something Nico would do.
Or just follows Percy.
Yeah, like, and Percy's trying to protect him the whole time. And he would be witness to Bianca's death if Bianca did die. Mm-hmm. And so he would have less reason to blame Percy because he actually would have been there to see it. I mean, maybe he still would have blamed Percy, but
you could have done more.
Yeah. But I think he would have seen Percy trying and looking for Bianca and all of that.
I think so, too. It definitely would have changed. Maybe Nico still runs away to grieve his sister. Mm-hmm. Maybe it doesn't change any of the other major events, but I think it would have changed Nico and Percy's relationship.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Yeah, so there might have been some interesting dynamics between them.
He would have been a little more sympathetic to Percy, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Or maybe he would have had a crush on Percy earlier.
Maybe.
Like, maybe that would have been even more...
Right.
Effect, you know, like, because he sees how much Percy is going through for Bianca, maybe his attachment to Percy's a little stronger earlier or something like that.
Yeah. All right, so we are back to our chapter reviews. I'm not going to lie, I kind of missed doing them last week, and then when I jumped into reading it today for this, I was like, I feel like I've missed so much. I've been gone for so long. It was very strange.
Well, and where the last chapter ended and this one begins, it's kind of like, oh, wait, what happened? Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay, all that happened, and now Percy's, okay, I got this.
Yeah.
All right. But yes, we are picking up with chapter 3 and 4, but chapter 3 is entitled We Play Tag with Scorpions, and here's our recap. Percy gets a decent night's sleep after the late night Iris message about Nico. He wakes up to find out that an Ethiopian draken prowled the border of camp in the night, and Percy slept right through it. Lee Fletcher and a couple others from Apollo Cabin managed to hit the monster with some arrows, sending it hightailing out of Dodge. Breakfast goes on, and Chiron brings Grover to sit at the Poseidon table. Annabeth joins when Chiron leaves, and we finally learn what Clarice was up to last year. She was exploring the labyrinth. It all started when Chris Rodriguez showed up near her mom's house in Phoenix, mumbling like crazy. Annabeth also believes this may be where Pan disappeared to, but Grover has no interest in exploring underground. It's a satyr thing. After an afternoon meetup with Blackjack, the whole camp meets up for war games in the woods, led by Quintus. He pairs everyone up to fight monsters and win a golden laurel wreath. Percy and Annabeth are cornered by 3 scorpion creatures when they find a narrow slit in the rocks and slip in, only to find that they were in a corridor of Daedalus' labyrinth. And this means if Luke finds a way to navigate the labyrinth, he can pop his entire army into the middle of camp. Da-dun!
That was a very strong finish at the end.
I thought so. That was pretty epic.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's not a ton of, like, action in this chapter, but there is a good amount of things to kind of, like, make your way through. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so, first of all, one of the biggest things we learn in this chapter is what Clarice was up to, what her secret quest was last year.
Yeah. That was pretty cool.
Yeah. So, the labyrinth. she random Chris Rodriguez, obviously on mission from Luke, because he was last we saw him, he was with Luke. Chris Rodriguez is sent, basically shoved into or sent through the labyrinth, and he manages to pop out at Clarice's mom's house, which is just, first of all, interesting that, like, I mean, it's a little bit of kismet. Like, thank goodness it was that near, because otherwise they might not have known what Luke's next move was. Right. But yeah, to think that while they were dealing with the Titan's curse and all of the, you know, Annabeth being gone, Clarice didn't really know about any of that because she was trying to figure out
what was
going on.
She was in the labyrinth. She was exploring it. That explains the, like, cut on her chin and her hair had been cut and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, what I find really interesting is Clarice and Annabeth have been investigating the labyrinth together. Like, because of the whole Chris situation, they kind of go in on it together. Clarice is there because of Chris, and Annabeth is there because she's obsessed with the labyrinth. It's, you know, magical architecture. She really loves it and has researched a lot about it. And I love this Clarice and Annabeth friendship. Like, I didn't know how much I needed this. I thought I really wanted Percy and Clarice to be friends, and, like, I still do. But her and Annabeth working together and not having that, like, you know, girls always fighting each other kind of thing, and Percy just having no idea why they're friends all of a sudden is, like, so funny to me.
Like, excuse me? What? Hold on.
I thought we hated her. What's going on?
She hates me. Why do you like her?
Yeah, this is not fair, Annabeth.
But yeah, so that's, it's a load off your mind to let you know. Clarice is not up to anything too, well, it's crazy, but it's not bad.
Not nefarious.
She is working with Annabeth, and again, I also love that friendship, that burgeoning friendship, because they're both very powerful ladies, and I'm always up for that. We also should probably make note that Annabeth is obsessed with the architecture, and she's brought in on all of this. Luke is looking for something specific to get himself through the maze, which we know thanks to our Minotaur episode.
Yes. Yep.
Is Ariadne's string.
Right.
And so, in addition to trying to figure out the labyrinth, there's also this little hanging detail of, if Luke finds the string, we're probably in big trouble.
Yeah.
Because, like, Luke trying to navigate the labyrinth on his own is not great, but it's going to take him a lot of time. Mm-hmm. If he finds the string, no more time.
Right, exactly. And the most interesting thing to me here is that Ariadne's string is not a string. It's a device that Daedalus created to navigate the labyrinth, because the labyrinth is literally designed to read your thoughts and trick you, which, first of all, terrifying. Like, no thank you. But if you can make it work for you, then you've got a chance. Or if you have Ariadne's string, then you can find your way through. And I'm like, okay, so this is very much like technology meets magic, and I really like that.
Yeah, no, I love all the craziness with the labyrinth.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things when you have something like the labyrinth where anything can happen, it just makes everything that much more exciting because you literally have no idea what's coming around every turn.
Right. So. And it's also huge. It's like under the entire United States and it's constantly expanding and moving and changing and morphing.
I did love the bit in this chapter where, I think it's in this chapter, where Percy asks about the labyrinth, like what city it's under, and Annabeth's like, she doesn't say it, but she's thinking, oh, seaweed brain.
Yeah.
It's not under a city, child.
It's under multiple cities?
It's under a country?
Yeah.
Maybe? Include some Canada in there. I'm pretty sure there's probably. Another thing that we learn is that Annabeth thinks that the labyrinth could help Grover locate Pan, including the fact that Pan may be trapped in the labyrinth.
Right.
Which would explain why nobody's found him. Because they've searched and searched and searched the wilds, and nobody has had any chance.
And satyrs hate going underground, so there's no reason for them to have gone to the labyrinth previously.
And if Pan got tricked or manipulated into entering the labyrinth, he might not even, like, he might be wandering the labyrinth trying to get out, too. I feel like maybe he would last a little longer and might not lose his mind as fast because he is Pan, and
he's powerful.
The labyrinth, while built by Daedalus is also underground, so I feel like there's a lot he can work with to stay sane and to try and navigate, mm-hmm. but even then, it would be very hard for him too.
Yeah, and Pan's power wouldn't reach the surface like it would if he was just out somewhere. You know, it explains why his influence has kind of taken a step back over the generations, too.
And if he's wandering around trying to navigate, it would explain why Grover could hear him in certain places at random times, like why he heard him... Was it in the junkyard or near the junkyard?
Before they got to the junkyard. Yeah, it's right
before the junkyard, mm-hmm. where he hears Pan and kind of, like, feels his influence. And then when he hears him at the end of Titan's Curse, when he's actually at camp.
Right.
So, like, it would explain why Pan is not necessarily in one place, even though everybody's...
That's true.
Yeah.
Right.
Because like, nobody's found him, so he's obviously not, like, wandering the wilds, but somehow he manages to be in more than one place at once. So mm-hmm. that's... Yeah. Anyway, we should probably talk really briefly about breakfast, because Annabeth breaks the rules. Annabeth's filling Percy in on a lot of this, because mm-hmm. he's still a little behind. And she sits down at the table, and... Like, everybody's, like, looking at her and mm-hmm. looking at them. And, like, she's breaking a major rule. And, like, nobody's saying anything because Kyren's gone. And Grover's, you know, just hanging out. And
yeah.
I just love that bit.
Yeah. And Percy is, like, self-conscious because she's sitting very close to him. And he's, like, everybody's staring at us.
But, yeah, he kind of likes it.
Yeah, he definitely likes it. Because
he's Percy
it.
And mm-hmm. she's
and she's basically trying to convince Percy to convince Grover to go right. into the labyrinth to find Pan. And Grover is just, he does not like the idea.
Nope, nope, nope. Yeah. Not at all. Which, you know, he's a satyr underground. Not good things.
Right.
Okay, so then we move right along. He does say hi to Blackjack. It's not really a big scene, so we're just going to fly right past mm-hmm. it. But Quintus is probably the next big event, because Quintus is running this war games scenario, yeah. which is not like Capture the Flag.
Right. But I actually really liked it. I thought it was clever. So they release like half a dozen monsters into the woods, and then they put these little silk packages on them, and inside one of them is a laurel. And if you can find the one with the laurel, then you win the game. And it's kind of a little bit like a treasure hunt almost, but also you have to fight off these monsters. And I feel like it's just a really clever game to have at camp.
I agree, especially because, you know, war games and learning to fight and learning mm-hmm. to fight monsters is very important. And working together to fight monsters is also, you know, pretty mm-hmm. valuable. So yeah, and I think the whole thing, it's a good exercise.
Yeah. I really think, you know how they make like Quidditch games are, like, real. Like, you can play Quidditch.
Yeah.
Playing the war games at Camp Half-Blood would be so cool, because you could have literally, like, a team of six against a team of six. Half of them are monsters with packages tied to them, and the other half are the demigods who have to, like, try to get... Like, you could make that a real thing in our world.
Yeah.
That would be so cool. That I want to cool. play it.
It would be a little bit like Capture the Flag, but also touch football, like, yeah. flag football. It'd be an interesting little game.
Yeah. Flag football probably would be the closest. Yeah. I would say.
With like a little bit of...
But you could do a twist on it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, no, that's... Only half of them have flags. So
right.
Yeah, it would, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I want to play it.
So, yeah. During this war games, they are cornered. Percy and Annabeth are cornered. I think it's on Zeus's Fist is yeah. the rock formation. Mm-hmm. They've talked about it a couple of times in the books. And they need somewhere to go. And suddenly Percy sees like a crack in the rocks, and he kind of like weasels his way back there and finds that it's big enough, and they slip in there. And Annabeth pretty quickly puts the pieces together and is like, hold on, Percy, hold your sword up, because glowing, just yeah. a little bit of glow. And she is smart enough to know the entrances to the labyrinth. There's a button that you can press, because where they fell into this slit in the rock has now closed, and right. it's now a corridor. So thank God Annabeth is smart and knows everything. Mm-hmm. She is able to get them out of there. But
otherwise, Percy would have been wandering forever.
Yeah. And we learn pretty quickly that they were in there for a while.
Yeah, like an hour instead of like the couple of minutes they thought it was.
So time is a little wishy-washy, right. timey-wimey.
Another reason why Pan being in the labyrinth could make sense, and mm-hmm. him still being alive and everything.
Well, and not having lost his mind, because if he's strong enough to withstand the power of the labyrinth mm-hmm. long enough, that, yeah, he would feel like he's only been in there a couple of months when he's been in there for decades or something. Yeah. Like, that definitely mm-hmm. tracks.
It tracks.
Can we also just mention that, like, Quintus definitely sent those scorpions after Annabeth and Percy, right? There is no reason why three of them attacked them at once.
Right. Yeah. It had to have been Quintus.
Yeah.
Nobody else would have, and they didn't do that on their own.
Yeah. We learn soon that Quintus is not to be trusted, but also, like, it was kind of obvious from the beginning.
Well, I was gonna say, is it a good thing that he sent them, or did he know something? I don't know. We'll see. We'll get to Quintus. Let's do our favorite quotes and favorite moments from this chapter. Karen, do you want to go first?
Yes. My favorite quote is from Grover, talking about, like, going underground to the labyrinth. I can't do it. Just thinking about it makes me want to throw up my silverware, because he just ate a fork. Grover is so funny.
I do love Grover. Yeah. His ability to eat random things makes for some very, very good quotes.
It does, definitely. Just makes me want to throw up my silverware.
Yeah. Mine is also kind of a Grover quote. It's a Grover Tyson moment.
Yeah.
After Percy and Annabeth have emerged from the labyrinth, mm-hmm. they're all looking for him, and they see who won, and Grover says, "We would have won, but a cyclops sat on me," and Tyson yells, "Was an accident!" and then sneezes. And I just love that Grover and Tyson were kind of forced into proximity because mm-hmm. they don't particularly love each other. Well, I take that back. I don't think Tyson has anything against Grover.
No,
not a huge fan.
I don't think Tyson likes Grover
really?
Either. Because his hair makes his nose itch and
right.
he sneezes and he just feels kind of uncomfortable.
That's right. I forgot about that. Yeah, okay. But yeah, so they're not the biggest fans. But yeah, I love, was an accident. Totally see Tyson doing that. Okay. And then our favorite moments, what was yours?
Annabeth holding Percy's hand.
I know.
In the labyrinth. It's so cute. Like, I mean, obviously I love the two of them together, but it's very quickly becoming all of my favorite moments are just them.
Well, it's easy to love those moments because they're so sweet and mm-hmm. wonderful.
And it's been such a good build-up to that when absolutely. It finally crosses that line, you're like, oh, thank goodness.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're in book four.
Yeah.
Mine was the entire camp giving them looks as Annabeth openly breaks a well-known major rule and mm-hmm. sits down next to them. So, yeah, mine are all Percibeth moments, too. We're both just victims of the Percibeth. Okay, let's jump into chapter 4, entitled Annabeth Breaks the Rules. A different rule, I swear.
Yeah.
Okay. Percy has a dream about Daedalus and his son being locked in a giant room after helping someone defeat the Minotaur. The man promised to take out Daedalus's wrongdoings on the boy. Then Percy wakes up. Chiron calls for a meeting in the sword training arena. All the usual suspects, plus Beckendorf, Selena Beauregard, Juniper, the Stoll brothers, and even Argus. Annabeth sums it all up and says that if Luke is able to make it to the middle of the maze and find Daedalus's workshop, he will have an ally to help him through the maze, and he will easily defeat our demigods before then moving on to Mount Olympus. There's a consensus that a formal quest is needed to enter the labyrinth and find Daedalus's workshop, and that Annabeth should lead the charge. Clarice refuses to step foot in the labyrinth again and runs off. Percy has a chat with Juniper while Annabeth is chatting with the Oracle. Juniper saw Quintus poking around at that labyrinth entrance, and she knew it was important. She said he, like, magically appeared there, and Percy definitely finds that weird. Annabeth then comes back, and she gets her quest complete with this prophecy. You shall delve in the darkness of the endless maze, the dead, the traitor, and the lost one raise. You shall rise or fall by the Ghost King's hand. Something about destroy with a hero's final breath. So there's a line missing there, if you notice the rhyme. Anyway, moving on. Annabeth then insists on inviting Percy, Grover, and Tyson along for the ride. Chiron tries to convince her to keep the party to 3 since it's a sacred number, but she insisted, so he relented. Quintus hits Percy up after people leave the arena and gives him a Stygian ice whistle that will call Mrs. O'Leary to his side, but it will shatter upon use, so it can only be used once. Percy goes to Athena's cabin to find Annabeth. She's nervous and digging through old maps. Percy asks her about the prophecy, and she starts to tear up. Needing a hug, she puts her arms out, and Percy pulls her into his, giving her a good one. His comfort works, but he has one last question for Annabeth. Since the prophecy ends with the word breath, does the line before it end in death? Dun, dun, dun. I feel like every one of these can end in a dun-dun.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, so first and foremost, prophecy count.
Number 16. Yep.
And this one is a, you know, pretty straightforward prophecy. Mm-hmm. The dream, which it kind of feels more like a memory, but
yeah,
we don't truly know anything right. about Percy's dreams.
He has dreams that are prophetic in some way, even if he is seeing the past. And I actually really loved this one. This was almost my favorite scene because it's so cinematic. I just feel like I really saw it. And even the way at the end that like the gate crashes down, like I could hear it, I could feel it, I could see it. And it's basically just Daedalus and Icarus being trapped in the labyrinth. And it's not hard to figure out that King Minos is the one that's keeping them there because they helped Ariadne help Theseus escape and kill the Minotaur.
I will say this is all helped by our Minotaur episode.
Yeah, yeah.
I couldn't remember Theseus's name, but I remembered who, like, I remembered which, that it was a hero and I remembered right. a lot about him, but mm-hmm. I was like, I can't quite remember his name. But I knew that it was Ariadne they helped, and I knew it was Icarus and King Minos, so it did help that we did that episode.
Good timing for us.
Right, good job us. Yeah, so that does help to kind of be able to put the pieces together, because Percy isn't 100% sold on who half these people are.
Right.
He obviously knows who Daedalus is, and I think if he tried hard enough, he could probably put together a few other things, mm-hmm. but he wouldn't know the whole story. Mm-hmm. So it helps us to just...
I'm surprised he doesn't have, like, Minotaur PTSD at this point. Like, oh my god, they mentioned the Minotaur.
Every time this thing shows up, it's bad news for yeah. Percy. So yeah, I can imagine. Not a huge fan. Not a fan. Okay, so next up on our list here, Annabeth is chosen to lead the quest. She kind of volunteers, but there's also someone who maybe suggests that should be the way it is.
Yeah, I think everybody kind of realizes that she'd be the perfect person to lead it because she knows so much about the labyrinth. But Clarice definitely says Annabeth should do it. Like, she knows the most about the labyrinth. And Annabeth is like, what about you? You've been doing a ton anyway. And Clarice, like, refuses to go back into the labyrinth.
Runs away.
Yeah, and she's not even, like, defensive about it. Like, she's sad. And one of the Stoll brothers is, like, you know, kind of picks on her at first and then realizes, no, Clarice is serious. And I don't think anybody knows how to handle that version of Clarice that is, like, genuinely scared and not even ashamed of it.
Yeah, yeah. She's usually pretty defensive when she's afraid or sad about something like that. Mm. Emotions.
Yeah.
So, yeah, seeing her be completely, like, solid in her thoughts, like, nope, I'm not doing it. You are. I'm leaving. Goodbye. And just takes off. Like, that, yeah. It's probably important to mention that Annabeth chooses, you know, says, yes, I will lead the quest, which mm-hmm. is a huge thing because she's been waiting for a quest for so long and she's gone on quests, but they haven't been hers. So I think it's important that mm-hmm. she finally gets her
and
quest.
And it being the labyrinth is like so perfect.
It is. Yeah. It absolutely is. But Chiron, like, makes the point to say, if you survive the Oracle.
I just love that, like, going to the Oracle is this, like, fatal mistake thing where you could either go insane or just die from fear at what you see.
Right? Like, it's a possibility.
Can we just make going to the, like, the pre-quest step shouldn't be as dangerous as going on the actual quest.
Right? And I think we don't necessarily think of it as being that dangerous because Percy goes all the time and, you know, mm-hmm. whatever, we get used to it. But it is. Like, it alone is a very, very dangerous thing.
Yeah.
Oh, the Oracle. So much fun. As Percy is waiting for Annabeth to get her quest, he kind of makes his way near the big house. He's impatient, whatever. And he runs into Juniper, who gives him his first real hint that Quintus is truly up to something. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's kind of had some weird thoughts, like, I don't know about this Quintus guy.
Yeah.
But she tells him that she saw him poking around Zeus's fist, which makes us all wonder, you know, he obviously knows that there's something going on there magical. Whether he knows it's the entrance to the labyrinth or not, that doesn't bode well
right.
for Quintus.
Yeah. I think it's really nice, actually, that Rick is making it obvious that Quintus isn't a good guy because, like, I definitely got weird vibes from him from the beginning. And I just had a random thought. I literally don't know if this is true, but is he calling Chiron Master Chiron because he's Cronus' son? And so he feels like if Quintus is working for Cronus and Cronus is his master, does Cronus' son Chiron also technically, like, is that his master? Mm. That could be why he's calling him that. I don't remember if this is the case.
I don't either.
I definitely don't trust Quintus. I want to because Mrs. O'Leary likes him, but...
I think... I don't entirely remember everything about Quintus. I have my moments where I want to believe that maybe he's not completely bad. Like, maybe they're... Maybe we're interpreting things in a weird way or something, but yeah, he's not.
This is suspicious.
Right. Oh, for sure.
Yeah. And I trust Juniper.
Yeah, so do I. As do I. Okay, so the next thing that we learn is as Percy is getting even more impatient and starts making his way through the big house, he hears someone crying and he kind of follows his ears and sees Clarice trying to help Chris.
Mm-hmm.
So Chris Rodriguez has been brought from Phoenix to camp and is still under the effects of the labyrinth and is still like completely lost in his own mind and doesn't know what's
He's
going on.
He's gone mad.
Yeah, so he keeps calling out for Mary.
Do we know who Mary is?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just like one of his friends or something.
Maybe, yeah, something like that, or even maybe a sibling or something. He's so lost in his own mind, I don't know if he'd know. And when Percy kind of comes up on the scene, he gets a little closer, and Chris almost looks directly at Percy and says something about a son of Poseidon. And Percy kind of freaks out, because he's like, hey, I don't want Clarice to know I'm here, because that would be bad, too.
Yeah.
So he kind of jumps back, but then he makes a point to say that it might not be him.
Yeah, he felt like he wasn't really seeing Percy when he looked at him. And I was trying to think, like, which son of Poseidon does Chris hate so much?
Well, I was trying to think of, like, legendary sons of Poseidon that he could be seeing, because maybe Chris doesn't hate him, but something that from the labyrinth, like, is, you know, hanging around. Like, maybe some of the Minotaurs hate for sons of Poseidon have been leached into the labyrinth. I don't know.
Or, like, Kronos or something like that. Yeah, I'm not sure.
There's definitely some questions surrounding what happened to Chris and all of that. So, I'm sure, I hope there will be a bit more explanation on that later. I don't remember, so.
Theseus is the son of
Poseidon. That's what I thought, but I didn't want to say it.
Yeah, I Googled it.
I don't like being wrong. That's...
I was like, that would make the most sense, honestly.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Hi, Callie.
Thoughts, Callie?
Do you like Theseus? Yes? No? No? So let's keep moving forward. We have Prophecy Count 17.
Before that, real quick, Clarice might have a crush on Chris. I just thought that was interesting.
I like that she has, like, emotions towards Chris. I don't necessarily know if it's a crush or whatever, but I like that she's being human
for him. And
it's really easy to see Clarice as like a must-have war kind of, you know, automaton almost. Like, she just is like, but she is a human being and she does have human feelings. And I like that we get to see a bit of her softer side as she tries to help Chris. It's a good moment. Okay. So now we're on to Prophecy Count.
Yes.
The next prophecy in this chapter, 17.
Yeah.
Which is Annabeth's prophecy, Annabeth's quest.
Right.
Okay, and I read it during the whatchamacallit, but we'll do it again just for clarity's sake. You shall delve in the darkness of the endless maze, the dead, the traitor, and the lost one raise. You shall rise or fall by the ghost king's hand, the child of Athena's final stand. Something else. Destroy with a hero's final breath.
Yeah.
So we're missing a stanza or something.
Yeah, it's weird, and everybody can kind of tell she's keeping something from them because she has a good memory, so there's no reason why she would have forgotten this very important prophecy that they need for their quest.
And Chiron definitely gives her some side eye, like, oh, honey, you've got to tell us. But he doesn't push it, and she keeps it to herself, so, yeah, there's that. There are a few ancient laws, or basically just guidelines that they follow with quests. One is that there are only ever three people. We learned that in Lightning Thief. It's why they sent Grover, Percy, and Annabeth. Mm-hmm. It's because they go in threes. Annabeth insists on a different number this time, though.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's interesting.
So do I, because we saw in Titan's Curse that there were five people, and only three of them came back. So, like, it's very bad when you break that law of three. And Annabeth knows that and is willingly doing it.
Yeah, it must be really important, is all I can say. Because she wouldn't She also would not jeopardize Percy, Grover, or Tyson, I don't think.
Right.
Without there being a really good reason. So, clearly, there's something significant convincing her to take all three of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she knows the maze better than anybody, so I trust her that this must be very, very important.
Yeah. And I just also want to say, like, she wanted Tyson to come along, and, like, they had it rough in the beginning. Of course, Tyson loves Annabeth to pieces, but I think it's just nice that there was no hesitation there for her. Like, she wanted Tyson there, and their relationship is much better these days.
Yeah, I do love that. Any Annabeth Tyson happy, that makes me happy.
Yeah.
Them getting along makes me very happy. Another important note, Quintus gives Percy a dog whistle for Mrs. O'Leary.
Mm-hmm.
It's Stygian ice and will shatter upon use.
I was, like, thinking of video games. Like, it's single use. And it's like, what's the point of a single use item? Like, it's so annoying, but...
Meanwhile, I'm thinking of the ice from, like, Game of Thrones and, like, the creepy dudes. Like, because everything's cold and frozen and dead, so that makes me all think of this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good to know. It's kind of one of those... What are they called? We'll definitely be seeing this whistle later.
Yes, yeah, like Chekhov's gun.
Yeah, thank you. That's exactly what I was thinking of. We'll definitely be seeing this whistle at some point, and we'll hope that it actually does call Mrs. O'Leary, because we can't trust Quintus, and we don't know.
And Percy is like, I'm not going to use it. And I'm like, yeah, you will.
You may have to. It may not be your choice. But he'll put it away for now. And then, lastly, at the end of the chapter, Percy goes after Annabeth looking for her because, you know, wants to chat. And he finds her in the Athena cabin, and she's kind of frantic and digging around. And you can tell she's trying to wrap her mind around the idea of going into the labyrinth and what do we need. And I want to make sure we have everything.
She's really shaken.
Yeah, and she's stressed. So she kind of, like, starts to lose her cool and reaches out for a hug. And he's, like, right there and is more than happy to give her a hug, and it's very sweet.
It's so genuine from her. Like, she's doing it because she needs his comfort. And he's, like, shocked at first, but then he doesn't hesitate either. He's just like, yeah, of course. Like, you know, he's kind of embarrassed and feeling, like, a little weird, but there's, like, no other option other than give Annabeth a hug. But she is a very proud person, and she doesn't like to show weakness. And I think in the past, she's closed herself off a little bit from Percy, just trying to, like, keep him at arm's length. Like, no, I can do this on my own. I'm smart. I'm capable. And, like, all that is still true, obviously. But the fact that she needed him in that moment is really beautiful.
Well, and I think it says something that she trusts Percy enough to be a little vulnerable with him. Like, it's not like she holds back once she realizes it's only Percy in the room. Like, she kind of lets herself go. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, you know what? He's the only one I can trust to kind of be weak with. And so she has a moment, as we all do. But yeah, it's such a cute moment. Okay. That pretty much wraps this up here. Let's do our favorite quotes and moments from this chapter. I will go first this time. Mine is when they're trying to figure out, like, what to do. They're talking about Luke possibly using the labyrinth and all of that. And someone proposes this. Says, wait a second. I said, if we're worried about an attack, why not just blow up the entrance? Seal the tunnel? And Grover says, great idea! I'll get the dynamite! And I think it's Percy who proposes the blowing up the entrance. And I just love that Grover's like, that's the perfect solution! Let's fix it right now. Okay, where's the dynamite? It's wonderful. I just love it. Love it. What was yours?
Mine is very much in the same vein, because Juniper says, I don't like yucky old caves. And Grover says, she has good taste, because, of course, he likes caves. And I also like the part afterwards when she's, like, all embarrassed because, like, she saw the entrance because she was kind of spying on Luke. And Grover just goes, never mind. Like, she doesn't have that good a taste.
Yeah, no. It's hilarious. I love it. Okay, and then my favorite moment was taken. By someone.
Really? Who did that? Callie, so, why did you take her favorite moment? Callie's, what do you have to say for yourself?
Callie's like, excuse me? Not my fault. No, one of my favorite moments from this chapter is Clarice taking care of Chris. I really love seeing her be so nurturing and, like, kind and sweet with someone, because it's not a side of Clarice we see. And just making, you know, exposing ourselves to that side of Clarice makes her a fully fledged human being, as opposed to just the war monster she can kind of come off as sometimes.
She's way more three-dimensional.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it makes me wonder if, yeah, there is something kind of going on between them. And it makes me almost hope so, because I want the best for everyone, not just Percy and Annabeth. What was your favorite moment?
Annabeth and Percy's hug. I know.
It's the best part.
It is. It's so sweet. I loved it so much.
Yeah, it's definitely the best part of this chapter, so. We'll leave it on that. All right. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to three other podcasts, including Rewatchable, where we rewatch canceled and cult classic shows, Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with creators, and Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which was recently revived thanks to the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast, or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. Please find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Consider leaving us a review or a 5-star rating, because those really help other people to find us. You can leave us questions and comments in any of these places, or ideas for content or episodes you might want to see or listen to us do. Yeah. We did get an email this week, and I am going to toss it back over to Karen for this email.
Yes, this is from our friend Quiva, who we love hearing from, and she says, "Hey, wanted to write in again. I never finished the last book in Kane Chronicles either. It took me a while to read the second book, and I just wasn't enjoying it. Not saying it was a bad book, just my personal opinion. I will probably read along with you, too. I like the characters. I just never really took to the Egyptian gods, but I respect the mythology, of course." So that's very exciting. I'm actually, like, stupid excited about reading Kane Chronicles, because it's going to be so new for us.
I was going to say, it's going to be brand new for me, because I've literally never cracked them open.
And I remember nothing, so it's going to be great. She also says, "I actually prefer longer episodes, because I love to listen to them and listen to the episodes while I do anything, go to the library or doing chores. The longer, the better." Thank you. I do appreciate that.
We will worry a little less.
Just a little. As long as Queeve is happy, then.
Right?
Who cares? Just kidding. Also, I'm sorry to say, after 33 episodes, I don't know what voice is which and who is who, but it doesn't impact my listening, which is good. That's fair. I feel like our voices aren't, like, super different.
Right.
But
I've listened to podcasts before, and sometimes I can't tell them apart.
That's also why I introduce us at the top of the episode every week, because I feel like it is hard to remember sometimes.
No, absolutely. If you're ever confused and need to know who said something, I guess, reach out to us on any of our places. We'll be happy to figure it out. It might take us a minute, too, because we can never remember what we say.
Yeah. I posted about your podcast on my Pinterest. I have a small following, about 15, but I know some other Percy Jackson fans follow me, and I want more people to find your show. I don't remember if you have, but if you haven't, you should do an episode on Daughter of the Deep. We did, actually. If you have, I forgot. Whoops, that's okay. You can go back and listen to it if you want to. I was at the library ordering Percy Jackson so my friend could read it, and I was talking to the librarian about Percy Jackson. She said her son, who is 10, loves the book. I told her about your podcast and also about the show coming out. It's very sweet. Aww. All my friends and my ma'am think I'm completely obsessed, and I am. I fangirl every time I hear you reading my emails. I love hearing other Percy Jackson fans talk about it and fangirling with me. Thank you for your amazing podcast. I get so excited every time a new episode comes out. That's great. I love it. It makes me feel so good when people enjoy what we're doing.
All this time we spend putting these together is worth it.
Yeah.
That honestly is the best part, is just knowing that you guys are out there and that you're enjoying your time with us. That's It's really, really great.
And if you would like to follow her Pinterest, it's Ayo, it's Quiva, that's AYOITSCAOIMHE.
Okay. Thank you again, Quiva. We really appreciate you. Okay, so next week, we haven't quite decided what our episode's going to be just yet. It could be a fan casting roundup, or it could be a monster guide about hellhounds, because we really want to talk about Mrs. O'Leary.
Yeah, so I figured if we don't get more cast members within the next week, we're going to do our fan casting roundup and just, like, hammer out, you know, who we want for Gabe, who we want for Chiron, like, all those other characters that will show up. If we do get those, we'll do some discussion about it, obviously, but then we'll also, we'll just do the Hellhounds episode. And if we don't do Hellhounds, then that'll be soon anyway. So now you can be prepared.
Sounds good. So yeah, just a little tip. There may or may not be an entire fan casting episode.
Yeah.
But either way, we'll probably talk about Hellhounds. So, okay. Until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio signing off. Over and out.